Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to this NIAC Talks podcast, Dispelling Myths, International Arbitration in the United States and New York. In this episode one, we look to the judiciary, and in episode two, slated for August 3rd, we'll discuss clashes of costs and cultures, with more on that at the end of the session. My name is Rekha Rangachari, and I'm NIAC's Executive Director. We're delighted to offer different styles of programs during Shelter in Place, where we can talk about topics in addition to and separate from pandemic. We're fortunate to again have so many of you on the line from global jurisdictions. Eduardo, Jennifer, Ari, and I thank each of you for participating. Today, we begin by considering drafting considerations for counsel in Latin America that will lead into a three-part discussion. First, the availability and effectiveness of interim relief in aid of arbitration and to disrupt arbitration. Second, compelling arbitration against non-signatories, a hot topic in the U.S. and previewed in the case of GE versus Outokumpu. And third, post-arbitration enforcement, procedural issues, and the application of manifest disregard in annulment proceedings. I'm joined by three leaders in international arbitration: Professor Eduardo Zuleta, a principal at Zuleta Abogados Asociados and member of NIAC's Global Advisory Board; Jennifer Permsley, partner at Skadden, Arps, Slate, Meager and Flom, and member of NIAC's Executive Committee; and Ari McKinnon, partner at Cleary Gottlieb, Steen & Hamilton, and NIAC Director. I also wish to thank our two supporting entities for co-sponsoring with us today: ALARB and New York City Bar's Inter-American Affairs Committee, each expanding our access and reach for programs like this. In particular, my thanks go to Klaus von Wobbeser, Maria Inez Cora, and Mike Fernandez. Two administrative items to all delegates. First, this session is being recorded. Second, as we progress through these topics, please submit your questions within the Q&A portal in Zoom. Time permitting, we may take these in real time as posed. Now, onto our program in chief. Eduardo, the floor is yours.
Thanks very much, Rekha. Thanks to NIAC for and ALARB for organizing this conversation. And of course, it's a great pleasure to have Jennifer and Ari in this panel. First, we need to set the scene, and the scene will probably be familiar to all of those who have done M&A or any other type of transaction in Latin America. It's maybe 2 or 3 in the morning or any other indecent hour. Your transaction is about to close, and then somebody says, who has an arbitration clause? Is there anybody who has a model arbitration clause? And then, of course, the arbitration clause, whatever the model, has two key issues. Number one, the seat of the arbitration, and number two, the applicable law. And unfortunately, those two issues that are key to the transaction are negotiated most of the times at the very last hour, at the 11th hour. And then, of course, the debate starts. The Latin American party would like a civil law to apply, a civil code that is common in the region, hopefully the code of its own jurisdiction, or in the worst case scenario, a civil code that is similar to the law of its own jurisdiction, and probably the seat of its own jurisdiction or a seat nearby in Latin America. Well, the other party would likely prefer a different law to apply and would likely prefer a different seat for the arbitration, hopefully outside of the jurisdiction of the Latin American party and hopefully outside of Latin America. And then New York comes into play. Somebody suggests, well, why don't we go to New York law and New York as the seat of the arbitration? And then at that point in time, the debate starts on a different topic, which is New York really a friendly venue for arbitration? And myths start going on. Questions as to whether it is friendly to arbitrate in New York or not, whether the New York law as the applicable law would solve the problems of a contract that has been already drafted in a number of cases drafted under a mixture of civil law, common law, sort of a Frankenstein contract that would end up governed by the New York law. And the questions arise as to what are the considerations that should be bear in mind if we are to arbitrate in New York and if we are to sit in New York. And then the myths, as I said, commence. I've heard, says a lawyer, that New York is not really a friendly venue. I've heard that there are not clear rules on interim relief, and there's a risk that the courts may intervene more than desirable. And somebody else says, well, I've heard that enforcing an award in New York is costly and that an action to set aside an award in New York may take forever, and then that you need confirmation. Other would say, well, what are the are there clear rules in New York if I have to, or if I want to get a non-signatory to the arbitration? And we're going to address, as Rika announced, three of those myths today. And those myths are related to the interaction between the judiciary and the arbitral tribune. The first of those myths is related to interim relief in aid of arbitration or to disrupt arbitration. In Latin America, as most of you probably know, the law clearly defines the scope of the remedies available to the parties by the arbitrators or the courts in terms of interim relief. Some jurisdictions, of course, adopt the language of the UNCITRAL Model Law, Article 17, that provides the type of measures that a tribunal may issue. Some jurisdictions with a monist approach, with a law that does not differentiate between national and international arbitration, provides for specific interim measures. Peruvian law, for example, which has the distinction between national and international, not as dramatic as in Colombia or Chile, but Article 47 of the Peruvian law provides for specific interim measures that a tribunal may order. The Brazilian Arbitration Act contains specific rules for the interaction between the courts and arbitrators as regards interim measures in sections 24A, 22A and 22B. And other jurisdictions with a dualist approach, such as the case of mine own jurisdiction, Colombia, where the arbitration law provides for the type of interim measures that the tribunal may take, but it's an exhaustive list of measures in the case of local arbitration. The Code of Civil Procedure normally provides for a very strict list of measures, a limited list of measures that the arbitrators and or the court may take in aid of arbitration. And the myth here as regards New York is whether, given that there's nothing in New York law, at least that's where the myth goes. There's nothing in New York law providing for the specific measures that a tribunal may take or a judge may take. So there's a fear that there's no limit under New York law for an arbitrator seated in New York or for a court in an arbitration seated in New York as to the type of interim measures that the arbitrator or the judge may take. So the question that I would have to my dear colleagues is, where can the parties look for guidance in that regard, given the absence of a specific statute, or more than a specific statute, the absence of a list of the type of interim measures that may be taken? Where can the parties look for the limits, if any, that the courts or the arbitrators have in that regard?
Thank you, Eduardo. This is Jennifer, and I'll start out with this question. When we were chatting in preparation for this discussion about the myth in Latin America, I found myself a little surprised because in New York, And as U.S. lawyers, I think we pride ourselves on how strong your courts can be in terms of aiding an arbitration through interim measures. We often tell clients in the context of negotiating their arbitration clause to be careful that they don't give up their rights to resort to a New York or another U.S. court for interim relief in aid of an arbitration, because it is such a powerful tool. And it is powerful in part because U.S. courts can be creative in the types of interim relief that they order. So if you think about the UNCITRAL model law, you know, the interim relief is really directed toward maintaining the status quo or desisting from an action that may harm the arbitral process, preserving assets, preserving evidence. In the U.S., the courts can do all of those things, but they also can do several other things. They can order a third party or a non-signatory to arbitrate in certain circumstances. They can order a witness to turn over documents or show up in the arbitration and testify if that witness is otherwise subject to their jurisdiction. They can appoint arbitrators in some instances where there's an impasse. And then I think the ones that create the most nervousness among folks are that they can order the parties to arbitrate, but they can also enjoin the arbitration or order the parties to stop arbitrating. They can also do so ex parte. So you can go into a U.S. court without notifying your opponent and ask them to issue a temporary restraining order. That can be issued within hours of having made the application right there by the judge on that very day. And therefore, this status quo in terms of stopping an action that your opponent is taking that you believe will harm the arbitration can be performed in a matter of hours, which is fairly uncommon among court systems around the world. So why don't I think that this should be a fear, or that do I think that having a concern about these broad powers is justified? Well, in part, it's because interim relief and also, sometimes thought of as injunctive relief, which are two different things in a way. Injunctive relief can end up being more permanent than just interim or temporary relief. But those standards for either of those in the United States are actually one of the most uniform standards of law that we have among U.S. courts. And they're fairly consistently applied, and the standard is pretty stringent. So parties, whether or not this is an application in aid of arbitration or otherwise, are all made to meet the same group of requirements. They need to show that they have a likelihood of succeeding on the underlying merits of the claim that they're making. They need to show that without the interim or injunctive relief, there's a likelihood that they will be irreparably injured. And that standard of irreparable injury is a really strong one, because the common law rule is that the ability to repair a harm through monetary damages itself means that the harm is not irreparable. So if you're just complaining that something is going to happen to you that later can be fixed through a monetary award, like one you would obtain in an arbitration, that won't rise to the level of irreparable harm. It needs to be something that cannot be unwound. It can't be undone later on. And then they also have to meet this balance of the hardships test, where not getting the injunctive relief would cause more hardship to the party seeking the injunction than it would to the party fighting the injunction. So there's all of those standards, and I just told you, well, you can go in and get an ex parte injunction in a matter of hours. That is true, but very soon after that, there will be a hearing that will be scheduled for a preliminary injunction, which will either extend or cancel the TRO, and those actually have a track record of going really either way. Judges, once confronted, typically goes to a different judge, and once confronted with the issues in a more holistic fashion with both parties present and in a type of evidentiary hearing, very often TROs are dismissed and the injunction is not continued. So those are all safeguards of the process against any type of broad interim relief that you might imagine. The other reason that I don't think that the interim relief granted by the U.S. courts is dangerous is because it's very, in context of an arbitration, it is very much intended to be a stopgap until the arbitrators get up and running. It is meant to be temporary in nature, and the measures can be adjusted or dismissed altogether by the arbitration tribunal once they're empowered, and that really is the purpose of an injunction or an interim relief application in aid of arbitration. And the only situation in which that is not the case is where the parties are actually asking for the arbitration, or one party is asking for the arbitration itself to be enjoined or stopped. And I want to spend a moment on that aspect of interim relief, because I think that it is one of the ones that gives a little bit more panic button to parties thinking about how U.S. courts will approach arbitration. It's not common around the world for courts to believe that an arbitration that is already in progress, maybe as simply because someone has filed an application or a demand for arbitration, can be stopped. But in the U.S., that is possible. And although there's not a Supreme Court case absolutely confirming the power to do so, most circuits that have considered the issue have said that they believe that because the Federal Arbitration Act and the New York Convention, which is subsumed into the Federal Arbitration Act, clearly give courts the right to compel arbitration, they must have what is called a concomitant right to enjoin arbitration. In other words, we can't allow courts to look at whether an arbitration is proper or not and tell them that all they can do is send the parties to arbitrate, but they can't alternatively stop the parties from arbitrating. The other thing about this power to enjoin is that it's very important to realize that it's really a power to enjoin a party from arbitrating. It is not an injunction issued to the tribunal, and it's not an injunction issued to the arbitrators. And the reason for that is that a fundamental concept that applies in U.S. courts is that you must have personal jurisdiction over the party that you're ordering to do something. So there must be, you know, another reason, another connection with the jurisdiction in which the interim relief application is brought in order for the courts to act in the first place. And this will be enforced. There are cases in which courts have said there's really just no reason for me to be acting here. Now, where an arbitration is seated in the United States, where the parties have agreed on a New York seat, the U.S. courts do have jurisdiction over that those parties, because the very act of agreeing to arbitrate in a seat itself gives rise to this notion of personal jurisdiction. So really, where you see U.S. courts exercising their power to stop an arbitration, it is very rare, but is in circumstances where they are empowered as the seat of the arbitration, so the courts that sit in supervisory jurisdiction over the arbitration. And the reason that's important is because in those instances, the arbitral tribunal is itself bound to apply the arbitral law of the seat, and therefore may consider giving deference to the ruling that has already been made of a court of the seat that the arbitration is not appropriate and should not go forward. Okay, so now that we've talked about the circumstances in which a court might think about even enjoining an arbitration, they're the seat, there's still some fear. Why would a court decide to enjoin an arbitration? Why does a U.S. court believe they can do that? And that really does go to, you know, maybe the myth is true. U.S. courts do still consider themselves to play an important gatekeeping function when it comes to arbitration. That gatekeeping function has been consistently limited by courts through the years to become a smaller and smaller role. But it basically goes like this, and this may be, you know, laws that many of you are familiar with. What the courts have said is that if there is clear and unmistakable evidence, and this is from a 1985 Supreme Court decision, clear and unmistakable evidence that the parties intended to delegate all of their decisions about whether a dispute is arbitrable, whether arbitration can proceed, to the arbitrators, then we won't interfere. But we need to see that on the face of the agreement itself. We need to see that the arbitrators were intended to resolve these issues. If it's not clear and unmistakable, then the courts will play that gatekeeping function and they will decide whether a certain dispute is arbitrable or not. This has been limited even further by most circuit courts in the United States that have addressed the issue, finding that where there has been an incorporation of arbitral institution rules, which themselves allow arbitrators to decide questions of arbitrability, that in itself constitutes clear and unmistakable evidence. So in the vast majority of arbitrations where you have the rules of an arbitral institution chosen in the agreement, and those rules allow the arbitrators to decide questions of arbitrability, the courts in the U.S. will not play the gatekeeping role. They will send the parties to the arbitration and allow the arbitrators to decide whether the dispute can be arbitrated or not. So the rare circumstance in which the power to potentially enjoin an arbitration is still reserved to the U.S. courts is where they either don't think that the decision was delegated to the arbitrators because of something unclear in the agreement itself as to whether the parties intended to do that, or because they actually have a good faith basis to believe that the arbitration clause was not agreed to in the first place. So that these are circumstances in which a party comes to it and says, it's not a matter of, oh, I think the agreement was terminated, or I think that this type of dispute wasn't within the scope of the arbitration clause. It's where the party comes to the court and says, I can tell you that I never agreed to this arbitration agreement in the first place. I'm either a non-signatory, or I never saw that contract, or I'm not a party to this at all, and someone is dragging me into this arbitration. And you can't delegate that to an arbitrator because I haven't agreed to delegate it to an arbitrator. In those circumstances, the U.S. courts will still play their gatekeeping role. They will look at whether or not they believe there's an agreement to arbitrate. If there is one, they will compel arbitration. And if there is not one, they may decide to enjoin the parties before it from continuing with the arbitration. And in that circumstance, it will be a matter of the opposing party and the arbitral tribunal deciding whether to go forward anyway in violation of that order and issue an award that will then need to be confirmed potentially by those same courts or to stay or dismiss the arbitration in deference to that decision. So that's an overview of where we are on interim relief and the powers that U.S. courts exercise. And in our next topic, we're going to talk about interim methods for joining a non-signatory to an arbitration, which is sort of part and parcel of this power that I've been talking about of the gatekeeper role and whether or not parties who say they didn't agree to arbitrate should be brought in nonetheless. It's sort of a corollary to this injunctive power that U.S. courts have.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Jennifer. Ari, in addition to any comments you may have, there's a question that arises here and something that we discussed in the preparation of this. From what I'm hearing from Jennifer, it seems that in New York and in the U.S., it is not possible to do what we've seen in Latin America, which is a court ordering the tribunal, not the parties, to suspend the arbitration or to do or abstain from doing something. Even courts that order arbitrators that are seated outside of the jurisdiction of that particular court to do or to abstain from doing something, or to terminate the arbitration. So in addition to any comments you may have on what Jennifer just presented, I would like to hear your views on this particular difference that I find in with Jennifer.
Yes, Eduardo, I'd be happy to address those. Hello, everybody. It's good to be here with you via Zoom. So just a couple comments to add to what Jennifer mentioned. I think one of the things that sets New York aside in terms of interim measures compared to a lot of the jurisdictions where I've been active in Latin America is the extent to which the pre-judgment attachment of assets is available. Now, this could be a good thing or a bad thing. It depends on whether you're on the respondent or the claimant side. But one thing that is different about New York is, one, there are a lot of assets that tend to be located in New York because it's a financial center, so there's a lot of bank accounts there. And two, New York law expressly provides that in aid of an arbitration and before there's an arbitration award, you can get prejudgment attachment of the respondent's assets if you're able to show a likelihood of success on the merits and that the defendant is a non-domiciliary, so a non-U.S. or New York resident. Most courts that have addressed this issue also require you to show that there's some likelihood of dissipation of assets, that you know the defendant's going to or respondent's going to squirrel away or remove his assets from the jurisdiction. But that's a big remedy that folks should bear in mind when you're talking about seating an arbitration in New York, where you've generally got a lot of bank accounts and where prejudgment attachment could be very much an issue. On the other point, Eduardo, which I think is a very interesting one, I mean, we've all come across, you know, cases. The case that comes immediately to my mind is the case between YPF and AESU, where you had a very strange, pathological, you might say, arbitration clause that provided for the arbitration to take place in Montevideo, but at the same time provided that Argentine law would arbitration law would be the sole means of challenging the award or seeking annulment. And then you had the Argentine courts and the Uruguayan courts both claiming that they were the primary jurisdiction, and the Argentinian courts eventually actually issuing an order to stay the arbitration, which ultimately the arbitrators did not comply with, at some, you know, personal risk to themselves, of course, were they to return to or be present in Argentina at some point in time. I think what certainly in the case of a foreign seated arbitration, where the arbitrators have no connection to the United States, as Jennifer mentioned, there's not going to be a mechanism for the courts in New York or elsewhere in the U.S. to direct the arbitrators themselves to stay the arbitral proceedings. I suppose, arguably, Eduardo, arbitrators in New York, judges in New York could or would have personal jurisdiction over arbitrators in a New York seated arbitration, to the extent that theoretically perhaps they could issue an order directed to the arbitrators. But I think as a matter of prudence, any such order in the U.S. and in New York would be directed to the parties to tell them to cease participating in the process. And I think there are a number I'm not familiar with any case in New York where arbitrators, even in a New York seated arbitration, have been ordered to stay the proceedings. But I think prudence would dictate that the New York courts would direct their order to the parties simply to cease participating or to cease advancing with the arbitration.
Before we move to the next topic, I have a question for Jennifer and for Ari as well. But you both have mentioned a standard for the granting of interim measures, which is a standard in the U.S. and in other jurisdictions, which is the likelihood of success on the merits. What is the standard? How far into the merits would a judge go to decide whether or not to grant a given interim measure?
So this is an interesting question, because practically speaking, you're looking for interim relief. You're not going to have, you know, a time for discovery or an entire, you know, evidentiary hearing on the merits of the case. So really, courts are looking for a showing that the claim is not frivolous, that there are arguments going in your favor, that you have a real valid claim. There are plenty of frivolous lawsuits in the United States, and if courts were asked to issue interim measures without paying any attention whatsoever to whether or not the claim might succeed, then there would be a lot of interim relief granted improperly. And so it is in practice a cursory look, but it is meant to at least give the court some comfort that there is a chance of succeeding on the claim, not a decision as to whether or not the claim is meritorious or not. And typically judges will not delve too far into those details, but they'll say that I am, you know, compelled to find that there is a claim here that may succeed on the merits going forward.
One of the things that was mentioned in Jennifer's introduction and then in Aaron's comments was the issue of the possibility of calling non-signatories to the arbitration. That's a situation that arises in complex contracts, a situation that arises when a local law, for example, requires the establishment of a company or a branch that is the one that normally signs the agreement, including the arbitration clause, but then the party or one of the parties would like to call the home office, the main company, the key company, the parent company, the operating company. There are scenarios where you have partial, not total assignment of rights, partial assignment of certain rights without assigning the contract. And then you find yourself in a situation where you have to call a non-signatory, somebody who did not sign the agreement, which in Latin America is difficult in Latin American jurisdictions. Peru has a particular provision to that effect, which is Article 14 of the Peruvian law, which says that the arbitration agreement comprises all those whose consent to submit to arbitration is determined in good faith by their active and decisive participation in the negotiation, execution, performance, or termination of the contract that contains the arbitration agreement, or to which the agreement is related. And it also includes those who derive rights or benefits from the contract. But other than that, when you have to enjoin non-signatories in a Latin American seat and applying the loss of the seat, you will always find difficulties because either the only provisions that you have to that may be applicable are the provisions of the given code of civil procedure, where of course meant to for judicial proceedings, not for arbitration. There are very few provisions in the arbitration law. Some provisions in the applicable rules, ICC, LCIA, that may not be totally satisfactory. But then the question is, when you see the way the non-signatories as parties to the arbitration have developed, one sees that the debate is mostly focused on figures such as agency, such as estoppel, which are more proper of a common law jurisdiction than in civil law jurisdiction. In the civil law jurisdiction, either you find consent or you don't find consent, and that's it. But how would it work, and would it be an advantage to be seated in New York or to have the New York law as the applicable law as an advantage to be able to call non-signatories to the contract? What has been the attitude of the courts to that, and what are the rules in New York for that?
I think that's a very interesting question, Eduardo, and a particularly relevant question to those of us who spend a lot of our time or all of our time practicing in Latin America, where it is quite typical when you have a big oil and gas project, a big infrastructure project and the like involving international companies, that the only signatories to the relevant contracts are the locally incorporated entities, as you mentioned, Eduardo. And then when an arbitration arises, one or the other party may want the sort of mother company or the parent company to be involved. Whether it's an advantage, Eduardo, kind of depends on what position you're in once the arbitration arises. Because what I would say is that under New York law, it is difficult. It is difficult to bind non-signatories. It remains difficult. It remains the view that arbitration is a creature of contract, and that only signatories, generally speaking, can arbitrate or be compelled to arbitrate. But there are more and more exceptions, I would say, to that principle in New York that I don't see as much in my practice in LATAM. Peru, as you noted, is a possible exception. But the U.S. courts have developed a number of theories under which non-signatories can arbitrate or can even be compelled to arbitrate. You mentioned a few of those. I mean, there are basically five of them. A couple of them are not controversial. You know, incorporation by reference or assumption. In those cases, you've basically got a non-signatory who's effectively become part of the contract, which I don't think is all that controversial. But the ones you mentioned, agency and estoppel, Eduardo, as well as veil piercing, have generated some controversy. In the case of agency, the way the New York courts have looked at this is that a non-signatory principal can be bound to an arbitration agreement when its agent executes the agreement on its behalf. Now, then the natural question arises, when is that locally incorporated entity going to be determined to be the agent of the, you know, the mother company or the parent company elsewhere? And that's really a fact-specific test. Well, you'll see courts come out on both sides of this, but what they're applying is the general laws of agency in New York. And they're looking at whether the agent has the actual authority to bind the principal. Did the parent company give the agent power to bind the principal? And then also they're looking at whether there's apparent authority, which is perhaps a strange doctrine to some of those on the line. But it's a doctrine that basically says if the parent made it seem like the local entity was acting on its behalf and generated in the mind of the other party the view that the parent was authorizing the agent, well, then the parent can be bound even if there was no actual authority. And the other one you mentioned, Eduardo, which is quite interesting, is this theory of estoppel, which, you know, when I'm doing cases in LATAM, I try to analogize to the doctrine of actos propios, but it's not a perfect fit. It's not a perfect match. And, you know, where this comes up is where the parent company or the principal takes some sort of benefit under the contract. For example, the parent company is receiving payment or is getting some other benefit directly under the contract. But then the parent company says, I'm not bound by the arbitration clause. And the courts in some instances has said that the parent in that case is, quote unquote, stopped or prevented from saying it's not bound by the arbitration clause because it would be unfair for the parent to take the benefits and not the burdens of the arbitration clause. And all of this it's quite interesting. These doctrines, these quote unquote common law doctrines, which have grown up in our case law, there was a big dispute in the U.S. as to whether they applied to international arbitrations, to New York Convention arbitrations, which, as Rekha mentioned in our introduction, was just actually resolved by the Supreme Court a few weeks ago in the GE Power case, where the Supreme Court held that non-signatories, even in the case of a New York Convention arbitration, can try to compel arbitration relying on the doctrine of estoppel in that case. Now, the Supreme Court did not find whether the doctrine of estoppel was satisfied or not in that case, but it did leave open the possibility that the doctrine could be satisfied in a case. Some courts had taken the opposite view, many courts, because you'll remember that the New York Convention has a clause in Article 2, Roman numeral 2.2, which requires that the arbitration agreement be, quote, signed by the parties. And some courts in the U.S. had taken a very technical view and said that provision of the New York Convention obviously requires that the clause be signed by the parties. So if you're a non-signatory, you cannot invoke it. And the Supreme Court just rejected that theory and found that's an overly formalistic or technical view of the New York Convention. And therefore, these theories that I've just been talking about, they are applicable to international arbitrations covered by the New York Convention.
Thanks, Ari. Jennifer, any additional comments? I'm interested in hearing a bit more on this decision that Ari mentioned from the GE case and the discussion on estoppel, because as Ari has clearly pointed out, there's sometime confusion between estoppel and what we call the theory of the own acts, teoría de los actos propios. So if you can expand on that a bit, on that particular decision and the status of the art in the U.S. as regards adjoining non-signatories.
Sure. So, you know, I think what's interesting about the equitable estoppel doctrine, sometimes also thought of as an implied consent doctrine, although they're a little different, but used interchangeably, is that it is one that could be used to encompass a number of different circumstances, almost a catch-all for areas in which it just seems unfair to not bind this party to the arbitration clause. And so in the GE case, the facts were that the party that had clearly signed on to the arbitration clause had said, well, in this case, I delegated all of my responsibility to a subcontractor, and that subcontractor was a subsidiary of GE. And they said, so go sue that subcontractor. And so the counterparty said, okay, well, I had an arbitration clause with you. If you delegated all of your responsibilities to a subcontractor, I'm going to go sue that subcontractor. And they said, I'm going to do that in litigation because I didn't have an arbitration agreement with your subcontractor. And in that case, the subcontractor, the GE party, actually said, well, wait a second, you should be equitably estopped from now trying to get out of your arbitration agreement. You should have to arbitrate with me as well, even though I was not a party to that agreement. So the idea really behind it, and you know, the Supreme Court did not actually rule on whether that theory worked in this case. They just ruled that the theory was available under the New York Convention. The case will be remanded for further decisions along those lines. The interesting thing about the theory is that the party in this case that was trying to avoid arbitration had signed an arbitration clause. And that actually is the history of most of these cases in the U.S. Have a party on one side who's fighting arbitration but has signed an arbitration clause. So they have already thought of and agreed to be bound by arbitration in some context. It's just not clear that it is in this particular context. We don't yet have the case that actually tries to bind the party that says, I had no arbitration clause whatsoever, nothing to do with an arbitration clause, and therefore you can't bind me. The case law is working up to that decision, but we haven't actually had higher courts seized with that decision, making a body of precedent that we can use there. A Supreme Court blog that was discussing the GE decision said the equitable estoppel doctrine is notoriously malleable. So it is true that the equitable estoppel doctrine can be used in a number of different circumstances. I recently had a case in which a party had for a year and a half sent letters to the other side claiming all of the things the other side had done wrong under a contract. All of the rights and breaches that had accrued over this course of this year. And then when they ultimately were sued in arbitration, they said, oh, well, actually, I don't think I'm bound by that arbitration clause. Look at the history of our negotiations. And they disclaimed all of the benefits that they had been, arguing and said, my claim is going to be based on something different. I'm going to counterclaim based on tort theories. The conduct of my counsel in sending a few letters referring to those agreements cannot bind me to the arbitration clause. And that is actually going to end up being a live issue that hasn't been decided yet, but it's a manner in which a party can use the equitable estoppel doctrine to say, wait a second, you can't on one side of your mouth claim the benefits and on the other side of your mouth try to disclaim the arbitration clause. So it's a doctrine that can be used in a lot of different types of circumstances to bind parties where it just really seems like it's not fair that they should,
Would it be fair to say that at the end, the difference is not that much, that in civil law, we normally look for consent, and all these theories at the end look for consent one way or the other, agency, estoppel, et cetera.
This is Ari. I think that's an interesting way to look at it, Eduardo, and I think that might be a way down the road to unify a lot of the case law in the United States, and to make it consistent with what we see in international practice. In other words, to focus on the consent of the parties. What you do see in a lot of the estoppel cases, though, is an undercurrent of a fairness analysis, less focused on consent, the technical issue of consent that you would normally think of in traditional arbitration practice, and more focused on, is it just unfair under these circumstances for one party to take the benefits or for a non-signatory to take the benefits and not to not the burden of the arbitration clause? You could probably rework a lot of those cases, as Jennifer suggested, so that they look more like consent cases. But as you work through the reasoning, there is a strong current in a number of the opinions of fairness as opposed to consent.
We now move to what I would say is the mother of all myths in selecting New York as a venue, and is the issue of manifest disregard of the law. There is the sense that when you are seated in New York and you you have an award, and then you want to enforce your award, there is, of course, the possibility of setting aside the award. And in setting aside the award, again, the myth goes to say, well, in setting aside the award in New York and elsewhere in the U.S., but in New York in this particular case, there is a possibility of setting aside the award because the court considers that there was a manifest disregard, and I quote those two words, of the law. And then the question goes, well, what is manifest disregard of the law? If a judge can determine that a decision in the merits disregarded the law, does it mean that the court or the judge can revisit the merits of the decision? Where is the limit that the judge has to determine whether disregarding the law in the particular case was manifest or not? Is the manifest, quote, a term, something totally subjective that would allow the court to annul an award simply because the judge disagrees with the way in which the tribunal applied the law, applied the law to the merits of the case? How far can a judge in New York go in applying this theory of manifest disregard of the law, if that theory is at all applicable for an arbitration sitting in New York?
Yeah, this is Ari. I think it's a very interesting question. The most arbitrations that we're interested in on this webinar that are seated in New York will be governed by the Federal Arbitration Act, because they're not going to be purely domestic. And under the Federal Arbitration Act, there are only specified grounds for annulling an arbitration award, procured by corruption or fraud, evident partiality among the arbitrators, misconduct by the arbitrators in failing to hear evidence, or the arbitrators exceeding their powers. That said, as you've noted, Eduardo, since 1960, the courts in the Second Circuit, which is the federal appellate court sitting above New York, have recognized another ground for annulment, which is this manifest disregard ground. There's some disagreement in the U.S. courts as to whether manifest disregard remains available after a 2008 Supreme Court decision in a case called Hall Street. But for purposes of this, webinar, it does remain available in New York and in the Second Circuit. And what it requires in order for you to invoke this basis to annul an arbitration award, you've got to show three things. You've got to show first that there is a clear and plainly applicable law. So it has to be a clear and plainly applicable law that was disregarded by the arbitrator. Disregarding that law must have led to an erroneous outcome. In other words, if you hadn't disregarded, or the arbitrators had not disregarded the law, the outcome would have been different. And the arbitrators must have known of the law, usually because the law was actually brought to their attention. And if you can show all three of those things, you can, in New York, still annul an award on the basis of manifest disregard. Having said that, it is quite a limited grounds for annulment. I mean, there have been some statistical studies done on how often this basis for annulment is raised. The New York City Bar did a study a few years back, which found that the Second Circuit, which again is the appellate court sitting atop the New York federal courts, had heard this basis 83 times in 83 cases and had granted annulment in 5 cases. And the story is similar in the district courts, which are the trial courts that hear annulment petitions in the first instance, where there had been 367 challenges on the basis of manifest disregard, and only 17 of those had been granted with 5 remands. So you've got about a 5 to 10% success rate on these manifest disregard challenges. Now, what you will hear from some who are concerned about this is it may be so that this sort of challenge generally fails, but it is frequently enough made, and it forces you to engage in some, litigation after the award has been rendered regarding the merits of the award. So there's still a fair amount of criticism of this standard. What the Second Circuit has tried to do, and most courts have tried to do since 2008, when the Supreme Court issued the Hall Street decision, is that when they're thinking about manifest disregard, they think of it as a gloss on those 4 bases for annulment that I mentioned under the Federal Arbitration Act. In particular, it fits well with the fourth basis for annulment, which is where the arbitrators plainly exceed their authority. And that's kind of the way the manifest disregard standard is generally applied today. So what I'd say in short is that it remains available, but it is highly unlikely that a challenge on the basis of manifest disregard would be successful.
Jennifer, any comments you may have on that same topic, which is, as I said, the mother of all myths and the mother of all fears when you select New York?
Yeah, so a few years ago, I participated in a debate, you know, a battle of the seats debate at, I think it was ICC conference in Miami, and I lost. I could not prove that New York was the best seat in the world because of manifest disregard. That was what the judges said, you know, it was their deciding factor. And, you know, and I said back to that in the commentary, look, if there's a decision where the arbitrator really did completely ignore you know, binding principles of law, I would hope that a court could do something about that in any jurisdiction, and that we wouldn't let a very extreme circumstance like that stand. And I think why it's a dangerous common law gloss that we have in the United States is because in the US, it is true that many different courts can adjudicate these issues. We don't have, you know, all of our commercial cases funneled into a single court, or all of our international cases funneled into a single court. And so you get many, many, many different judges with the ability to read, you know, the standard and do what they will with it. And so you get decisions that are interpreting the standard in a way that it was not meant to be interpreted. You know, one of the big ones that made a lot of headlines in recent years was where a New York State Court trial judge, actually the trial judge who had been appointed to handle all international arbitration cases, so, you know, unique instance where there was a judge appointed, overturned an award based on manifest disregard of the law, saying that the arbitrators had really, you know, ignored a principle about whether or not a certain counterclaim could be sustained in a case. And the Court of Appeals and the appellate division in New York overturned that decision about a year later. And they said, look, actually here, you know, they give dicta in their decision that indicates that maybe there was an error. The arbitrator really got it wrong. But it didn't rise to the level of ignoring the legal principle, because you can actually see the arbitrator applying the legal principle, struggling with the legal principle, and maybe at the end of the day getting it wrong. But that's not manifest disregard. And so you have enough checks and balances in the U.S. where courts using manifest disregard in a way that it's not intended to be used hopefully will be overturned or reversed. It does, of course, create an issue where the parties have to deal with that and deal with that possibility. But it is fairly consistently reserved for only the most extreme of circumstances. And the other reason why it's a little bit of a controversy is because the New York Convention does envision that courts will be able to vacate arbitration awards based on their domestic arbitration law statutes. We have this manifest disregard principle in the FAA Chapter 1. It's not actually a statutory concept, but the common law concept has come from the FAA Chapter 1 domestic law principle. And there it actually really does play a very important function, because in the U.S., arbitration is available for lots of different types of domestic cases, employment cases, you know, clauses that are in contracts for services agreement, like your cell phone. And there's a lot of arbitrations that are small arbitrations that arise out of these issues where arbitrators are appointed that are not faithfully appointing the law. And therefore, manifest disregard is really needed in those circumstances in order to catch extreme violations or extreme disregard for legal principles. It's not clear it's really needed in the type of sophisticated international cases we typically see under the New York Convention. And there have been a few circuits in the U.S. who have said, we actually don't think manifest disregard should be available under Chapter 2 of the FAA, which governs international awards. That is still the minority position. But that's a little bit of where the trouble stems from, is that it is a doctrine that's needed for domestic cases and is maybe improperly applied in some rare international cases.
That seems to be a common feature of arbitration in the Americas. We're seeing part of the myth seems to be that issues that apply to local arbitration sometimes are debated internationally as if they apply generally to international arbitration. So that seems to be the case of manifest disregard. That seems to be the case of some constitutional actions, the so-called amparos in Latin America, that you see cases where the amparo is granted, and those are arbitration, local arbitration cases, but then the debate is taken as if international arbitration would be affected by that. But in connection with this recognition and enforcement, action to set aside, confirmation, the other myth, in addition to the alleged risk of the manifest disregard of the law, is that there is the sense, there's a view that if you're seated in New York and then you get an award, you have to go to sort of two parallel proceedings. One is the action to set aside the award. But in addition, if you, as the succeeding party, in any event, you would have to get confirmation of the award. So under normal circumstances, you get an award seated elsewhere. And if neither party files to vacate the award, and that's the end of the story. But there is a sense that in New York is different, in the sense that even if neither party files to set aside the award, then you need, in any event, confirmation. And if a party files to set aside the award, then you have sort of two parallel proceedings, one to vacate the award and the other to confirm the award. So I would like to hear your comments on that. I would say Ari first, and then Jennifer.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I just wanted to mention one thing following on Jennifer's comment, which I think is really important, and what you said, Eduardo, as well, about domestic arbitrations versus international arbitrations. And that is, you know, of those cases I mentioned, the 22 times federal district courts, the trial judges had vacated an award on the basis of manifest disregard. None of them, so zero of them, were international arbitrations, and nearly half of them were employment law cases, where you see a lot of litigation for the reasons that Jennifer mentioned. And the Second Circuit's most recent case on manifest disregard, where they recognized the standard is still applicable, was in a case that involved a person who had defaulted on her student loans and was then called a million times by the lender, you know, harassing her to repay her student loans. Those sorts of arbitrations are, you know, really where you see a lot of the manifest disregard standards disputes taking place. On this issue of, you know, parallel proceedings, first, we could all be optimistic, maybe not realistic, and hope that after the arbitration's over, the losing party will simply pay the award, and that would obviously avoid the need to seek confirmation and any vacater or annulment proceedings. But I think many of us are seeing in our practice that that's perhaps becoming a little bit less common rather than more common. So the basic procedure, if you've got a New York seated arbitration, is that if you want to confirm, if you want to enforce the award, and the other side is refusing to pay, you would need to confirm the award and convert it into a U.S. court judgment. And once you've got that U.S. court judgment, you could take that U.S. court judgment elsewhere, or you could use it in New York as a basis to execute upon the other side's assets. Frequently, we do see that when a petition to confirm or recognize an award is brought, at the same time, you'll have a motion to vacate the award by the losing party on the basis that we've discussed under the Federal Arbitration Act and occasionally under the manifest disregard standard. My experience has been that those two things tend to be litigated together. So you tend to have your motion to confirm and your motion to vacate dealt with in this very same proceeding and dealt with fairly efficiently. I've just had a case in Texas involving Petrobras and a Texan company called Vantage, where we did the motion to vacate and the motion, the other side's motion to confirm at the very same time before the lower court in the Southern District of Texas. That proceeding was wrapped up, I think, fairly expeditiously. We had a lot of, we made a lot of arguments, but it was, I think, about 7 or 8 months before the for the trial court to issue its judgment confirming the award. And we've already, within a year, had our appeal heard by the Fifth Circuit. So there is often, you know, that dual procedure, Eduardo, where you have a motion to confirm and a competing motion to vacate. But my experience is that relevant, relative to some of the LATAM jurisdictions where we work, it's fairly expeditious. You can usually get through the lower court, the trial court phase, within, you know, 6 to 9 months, maybe a year, would be my kind of estimate of how long it takes. And of course, there can be appeals thereafter, which can extend the proceeding a bit. But if you've already got a judgment in hand, you've succeeded in confirming the award, you know, to appeal, a lot of times you've got to post a bond, or you just got to pay the judgment and appeal. It can be fairly efficient, I think.
Okay, thank you. Jennifer, any comments you have on that? And I have a couple of questions, but any additional comments you may have?
No, I think Ari's covered it. We can leave it there.
Okay. What I'm hearing is that you can have sort of parallel proceedings. You have a proceeding to confirm the award, and you have you may have at the same time the proceeding to set aside the award. Why, Jennifer? That was my question. Why is the confirmation needed? If one looks at the U.S. trial model law, New York Convention, it seems like a sort of a double X quarter that was the idea under the old Geneva Conventions, et cetera, that you have to get confirmation of your award by a local court, where in other jurisdictions you may enforce the award directly before, or not before, but you can enforce the award directly without any confirmation from a court. So what's the reason for that, and how difficult is that?
Yeah, so, you know, I don't know historically what the reason is, but I think that in terms of difficulty, it's not overly difficult if there's not a challenge to the award, right? If there's a motion to vacate, then the court is going to have to deal with whether or not they should vacate the award. If it's just a confirmation proceeding, the court will not really look into the details at all, but will rubber stamp and, you know, move forward to a judgment. I think one of the things to remember here is that although the U.S. courts are active and sort of, you know, in some ways can be seen as interfering or creating procedural hurdles, they also give a lot in return. And so once you have that judgment confirmed in the U.S. through what's hopefully a streamlined procedure and no vacator challenge, you then get the benefit of the very wide-ranging, for example, discovery procedures and aid of enforcement that U.S. courts could provide, could possibly give an order for worldwide discovery over the assets of an award debtor. So the courts, you know, in some ways, if you can get through the process, you'll actually get a lot in return. And I think that small gatekeeping role that the courts still play in confirming the award then allows them to have the confidence that they have something in front of them that they can issue further orders on, you know, preserving assets, finding, locating assets, executing on assets, directing a court martial to go attach assets, all in aid of this judgment that they've at least put through a minimal process in order to ensure that it is a proper court judgment.
Is there any evidence that is admissible in the vacating the award, in the action to vacate the award? I've seen cases in Latin American courts, in Latin American seats, where the court has opened proceedings for evidence or submission of documents. Even one case in which the court called a witness. What is the situation in New York? Is simply a matter of debate on the grounds, period? Is there any evidence admitted in the action to vacate the court?
Generally speaking, the proceedings are supposed to be summary proceedings. And that usually means that there is very little, if any, evidence that's submitted, that the case is often decided largely on the papers, with maybe an oral argument. That said, there are some exceptions. We've had a recent case here in New York where the arbitrator was called to give testimony on one of the Federal Arbitration Act grounds for annulment, on whether there was an evident partiality related to an undisclosed conflict of interest or an allegedly undisclosed conflict of interest. So one of our judges in the Southern District, Judge Rakoff, actually called the arbitrator in for questioning. And I believe Rakoff, the judge, led the questioning, perhaps with the parties being able to submit questions in advance for, you know, the judge's consideration. There have also been cases usually involving undisclosed conflicts of interest, Eduardo, where arbitrators have been deposed. And that, again, you know, in U.S. practice is certainly very different from practice in nearly all LATAM jurisdictions in this respect. A deposition is essentially where a witness is called in with a court reporter and he gives sworn testimony in response to questions by counsel. And there have been a few cases, a handful of cases, where arbitrators have been called in and have been subpoenaed and forced to give testimony after the fact about whether there was an undisclosed conflict of interest. I've just worked on a case I mentioned in Texas, where we had requested the testimony of an arbitrator in a very, very strange case, where the arbitrator had issued a two-sentence dissent, which essentially indicated that our client had been denied all of the protections of the Federal Arbitration Act, all of the due process guaranteed by the Federal Arbitration Act. And the arbitrator said nothing more. And we had requested a deposition of the arbitrator to try to understand what was he talking about. That request was denied by the district court, and that is currently up on appeal before the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. So there's some very limited instances, Eduardo, where there can be evidence and can even be evidence taken from the arbitrators. I would describe those instances as the, you know, extreme exception rather than the rule.
Okay, thank you. Another question that arises from all this debate and that we discussed in the preparation, Jennifer, is the interplay between the Panama Convention, the New York Convention, the Federal Arbitration Act, because the Panama Convention is rarely applied in Latin America, even though it's an American convention on international arbitration. The courts basically look to the New York Convention. But what is the interplay in the U.S. in general, and New York in particular, the interplay between these three statutes, the Federal Arbitration Act, the New York Convention, and the Panama Convention, that I understand has a key role?
This is Jennifer. I may have missed the very beginning of the question, as my line cut out for a moment. But, you know, generally speaking, I think that the cases you see by and large perform their analysis under the New York Convention, even where they mean to be referring to the Panama Convention. There is a bit of maybe sloppiness in the courts, or maybe in the parties arguing to the courts about exactly which convention is applying in a particular case. The FAA, the Federal Arbitration Act in the U.S., incorporates the New York Convention almost in its entirety into Chapter 2 of the Federal Arbitration Act. So when you hear a court or see a court saying that they are governed by the Federal Arbitration Act, that doesn't necessarily mean that they are viewing only, you know, domestic arbitration law standards. They may also be incorporating the New York Convention language by reference to the FAA, because it is itself within Chapter 2 of the FAA. You see, for the most part, when a party is seeking to vacate an arbitration award, you see the courts generally relying on the FAA Chapter 1 domestic arbitration principles. Those are almost identical to those that are found under the New York Convention, but with a few differences, and of course, this gloss of manifest disregard that we discussed before. And there has been a bit of a movement among courts to say, look, arbitrations conducted under Chapter 2 of the FAA, you know, New York Convention arbitrations, should not necessarily be subject to all of the same rules as FAA Chapter 1. Typically, the way it works is if Chapter 2, the New York Convention, does not address a particular issue, then the parties can rely on FAA Chapter 1 to make up the gap. And, you know, some courts have said that there should be a different view, that the New York Convention arbitration should only be governed by the standards in Chapter 2, which would presumably take away the manifest disregard as an option altogether, because that is an FAA Chapter 1 domestic law concept that applies. So I don't know if that answered your full question, Eduardo, as I may have missed a little bit of it, but that's a general overview.
No, that's perfectly responsible. Thank you very much. I don't know, Rica, but I think it's time for us to address the questions that we have from the attendees.
Yeah, well, actually, you all have subsumed many of the questions posed within your dialogue. And so what I would invite perhaps is any final comments, and we'll go into the conclusion.
This is Ari. I noticed one. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Eduardo.
No, go ahead. I think that there's one question that is a very interesting one, that the choice of a Latin American law as the applicable law in exchange for a U.S. seat.
That was exactly where I was going to go, Eduardo, because it is a fascinating question. And I've seen this sort of negotiation take place at the end of you know, when you're trying to sign an M&A agreement. So the question is basically, what about, you know, swapping or agreeing to exchange, you know, a LATAM, use the LATAM law as the governing law for the dispute, but let's choose New York as the seat so we get the New York lex arbitri. Interesting question. It creates a lot of complications that are probably, you know, make me go beyond the scope of this conversation, but I've encountered a few of these complications just in recent cases. So, you know, let's say you've been negotiating the contract and you've got common law principles in mind. It's an M&A contract, and you negotiate a whole bunch of representations and warranties, which are a concept that we use in a lot of our purchase agreements in the U.S. and in other common law jurisdictions. And then at the end, you swap in local law, maybe it's Brazilian law. You may be stuck with kind of a Frankenstein, as Eduardo mentioned at the outset, because Brazilian law doesn't have as well established or the same concept of reps and warranties that maybe we're used to as U.S. practitioners, right? So another issue is the availability of damages. In some jurisdictions, in order to get your full measure of damages, you may need to prove some level of dolo or, you know, fault in the contractual breach, which might sound strange to someone who's coming at it from a U.S. kind of breach of contract perspective. So there could be substantive legal differences in the jurisdictions that counsel a lot of caution when swapping governing law at the end of the day in a purchase contract. And I would note, finally, one complication that we need to bear in mind is that when you've got a New York seated arbitration, but you've got a foreign law, you're going to have oftentimes translation issues. And translation can be costly and sometimes ineffective. You know, if you're trying to bring issues to the attention of a New York court, but issues of foreign law, or you're having to translate a lot of foreign laws because you've got a foreign law governed arbitration, that can increase the expense of the confirmation proceedings or the vacatur proceedings in New York. And it can also compromise the results of potentially compromise the results of those vacatur or confirmation proceedings, because you've got a court that's maybe not best positioned to consider the legal issues at hand, and maybe more than that, is working with, you know, translations which are not always perfect. So very interesting. I think that compromise that our audience member talked about is something we see, but I would counsel caution and care when thinking about that compromise.
Thank you, Jennifer. Any additional comments on your side?
No, I thought I'd make a quick comment on another question that I saw just come into the queue about whether or not a court should consider adopting a more international standard for interim relief rather than a standard that replicates domestic law. And the only thing I would say to that is, at least if you look at the UNSA trial model law, which is one version of an international standard, the U.S. standard is not that far off. I mean, it seeks an arbitral tribunal issuing an interim measure looking for harm not adequately reparable by an award of damages and a reasonable possibility the requesting party shall succeed on the merits. So those are, you know, the two most important factors that you see in the U.S. Cases as well. So I would say that we're close to having a uniform view as to when interim relief should be granted. Maybe just not the type of interim relief that can always be granted. Maybe U.S. courts are a little bit broader in that regard.
I think following...
Okay, I think we...
Just very Go quickly, ahead. Following on what Jennifer just mentioned, I had a recent case before an emergency arbitrator in a Chicago-seated arbitration, international arbitration, where we argued successfully that the arbitrator should apply the international standards as opposed to the, you know, the Illinois standards. At the end of the day, I think we would have won under either standard, but our emergency arbitrator agreed that in the context of this New York Convention international arbitration, it was international standards that applied and not the local Illinois standards for granting preliminary relief. I don't think that that's the conclusion you'll get in every case, but it is the conclusion that we got in that that recent case I did.
I would agree with Jennifer in that the international arbitration tribunals are trying to look more and more into international standards based on UNSA trial model law, UNSA trial rules, as opposed to applying local standards. So I think we're getting there. With this, it's 1:15, so it's time for our closing remarks. I would like to thank Ari, Jennifer, very much for your excellent presentations and comments on these myths. We will have a second and third round to go over other myths involving arbitration with New York as a seat. But I want to thank you both for your intervention, patience, and of course, Rika, for your organization of this talk, and all the participants. We'll see you in the next one. Thank you very much.